From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll speak with the filmmakers of No One Asked You, a documentary about how humor can be used in the fight for abortion rights. Then, we'll learn about a program that introduces high schoolers to agriculture, nutrition, and careers in science.
When I was thinking about what's one of the best ways that I could give back or one of the biggest needs, it was absolutely food in some capacity.
Plus, we'll tell you about the Wisconsin Grilled Cheese Sandwich Championship happening in Dodgeville.
Everybody uses different things. You can use pesto, people have used bacon, ham, just different kinds of things that you can use. So it's as creative as you want to get.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. This week, the Arizona Supreme Court ruled that the state must adhere to a 160-year-old law banning nearly all abortions. It's the latest state to peel back abortion access since Roe v. Wade was overturned. A new documentary called No One Asked You follows comedian Liz Winstead and her abortion access front, made up of activists, writers, producers, and fellow comedians who use humor to destigmatize abortion and fight against anti-abortion groups nationwide. The documentary follows the group's 7-year journey, including a stop here in Milwaukee that puts abortion providers and clinic volunteers in the spotlight. No One Asked You is directed by Ruth Lightman and co-produced by Susan Kearns. Ahead of its screening at the Milwaukee Film Festival this weekend, they join me now. Ruth, Susan, welcome to Lake Effect.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
So how did you come to know of the Abortion Access Front and the Vagical Mystery Tour spearheaded by comedian Liz Winstead?
I met Liz in 2012 at Netroots Nation, which is this amazing conference, best of grassroots organizing on the net. And Liz was there with her book, Liz Free or Die, which had a really beautiful essay in it about her abortion story, which really resonated with me. And then, you know, cut to 4 years later, it's the day after the 2016 election, and I'm watching MSNBC as I would often, and there would be Liz talking about what is happening in abortion access, except now things are about to get much worse. And so, you know, as all of us were, you know, sad, crying, trying to figure out what we were going to do, I thought, wow, this is about to be really awful. And I need a little levity. I need a little, you know, comedy in my life. And we were really fortunate that we reached out to them and they were willing to let us follow them with a camera for what turned out to be 7 years. And, you know, this sort of flashpoint was that they were about to go on the Vagical Mystery Tour, a 16-city USO meets Habitat for Humanity tour across the Midwest and Southern battleground states.
Susan, can you share how you became involved in this film, some of your roles over the course of filming, and go into a bit of detail about what the Vagical Mystery Tour involved in visiting clinics around the country?
Yeah, so I will talk about my involvement, and then I'll pass it back to Ruth for the Vagical Mystery Tour part. I actually became involved later with the Garbage Fire Festival that was in Milwaukee. So Ruth, she knows that I live in Milwaukee up here. So she was like, hey, this is happening. We need a bunch of filmmakers, and we need to cover different parts of the city at the same time. You know, can you help? And it was really kind of an amazing moment, I felt like, for Milwaukee to kind of rally behind this film, because we literally had teams of filmmakers in different parts of the city covering things like not just the comedy shows, but also the protests that were happening. And it was really exciting to see filmmakers come out to want to support Ruth, want to support Abortion Access Front, and really want to make sure that people in the city knew what was happening to help support our ability to protect abortion access in Wisconsin. Because as you know, Wisconsin has been back and forth a lot recently. We're fighting the good fight, but it is something that I think people weren't always thinking about until it was too late. And so this was a moment where people could start getting people excited to think about it before things got really bad.
And Susan helped to facilitate literally crews all over the entire city because there was so much going on. But the reason for the Garbage Fire Festival in the first place was it was a counter protest to what was happening in the city. Every year, anti-abortion extremists find a city in an abortion vulnerable state and descend upon that city and state for a week to 10 days. And in 2019, they picked Milwaukee and also Madison. And the clinic, Affiliated Medical Services, was a really vulnerable clinic, both physically and politically, what was happening in the state. And right across the street is a CPC, a fake clinic, a crisis pregnancy center. So there was a lot that was happening like right around the clinic. And so Abortion Access Front job role in all of this was to keep the protesters, keep the anti-abortion extremists away from the clinic while they were there. And well, as you see in the film, visually there was, you know, they made themselves known very much so.
So Ruth, you mentioned one of the jobs of people involved in the Abortion Access Front was to be that buffer between the anti-abortion protesters and be a barrier for people going to the clinic. But another thing they did, not just in Milwaukee, but in cities all over the U.S. that this documentary explores in other clinics, they do everything from painting to organizing to writing support notes to having abortion stigma workshops and a comedy show to talk about these issues while giving providers some levity. So the whole concept of humor as a radical act, can you talk about that a little bit and how that's a focal point to this film that's obviously a very heavy present topic always?
Sure. I mean, I think that in the pro-abortion movement, there are so many different organizations, people who provide support in different ways. And one of the reasons why we decided to follow Liz and Abortion Access Fund is centering comedy and using comedy and outrage as a way to bring people together and bring empathy and love and joy to something that's really hard every day. And so what you see in the film is Abortion Access Front going to one of these 16 cities and beyond and getting to know the people at the clinic, getting to know the providers and getting to know the clinic escorts, listening to them about what they need. Do they need some new steps because somebody tried to trash their stairs? Do they need water because they're in the middle of Mississippi and they need cartons of water to bring to the escorts? And then Liz used her celebrity to bring together some of the best up-and-coming comics from across the country and bring them to these towns to have a comedy show, bring people together, build a larger community so that when the comics left, they had a good time and these people could volunteer and be involved. And then, of course, there was a talk back afterwards so that people would understand what was happening locally in their community. And it was sort of a model that worked, and they did it everywhere. And so that enabled us to go back to the same places over and over again to get to know what was happening with the clinics, to film them over a series of years, because it started to become really clear before the Garbage Fire Festival. It started to become clear the year before in Indiana, when we were in Indiana, that with all of the copycat laws that were coming down the pike then around abortion and now about abortion and trans rights, that we were on a race to the bottom. And one of these states was going to be the state that overturned Roe.
This film also centers the providers. Yes, it's about this troupe of comedians and other volunteers visiting clinics, but it really ask them, what do you need? What is your concern? What can we help with, no matter how big or small? And I'm curious about, with your experiences in these different cities or here in Milwaukee, what are the commonalities that you found in the people who staff and volunteer at abortion clinics across the U.S.?
I'll tell you one thing that's really beautiful about the escorts from Affiliated Medical Services. So after Roe was overturned and they had to close, and everyone had to close in Wisconsin, you know, they were really working hard to be able to come back. And when the clinic reopened, those same escorts came back, which is, you know, incredible. You know, one of them went off to grad school to come back. You know, they went off and did what they needed to do with their lives, but they came back because it's a calling. I think the commonality with all of them is that they're going to integrate their life plans, their work plans around being a clinic escort. So you have Dorinda in Mississippi who planned her work and really reduced her work so that she could be a full-time volunteer and a part-time restaurant worker. And I think that that's a commonality with all of them, is that as hard and as brutal as this work is, they're not going to abandon it anytime soon because they know that their work is critical to turning the tide.
I think that not exactly about the escorts, but one of the things I was thinking about when Ruth was talking is that because they had been working on this film before I became involved with it, I was able to see clips about what they were doing while they were on the Vagical Mystery Tour and how they were approaching the film. And I think one of the things that was really exciting for me is that it felt like I was the target audience for the film because I hadn't been keeping up. You know, I knew that things were bad. I didn't know the details. I had tried to sort of follow things here and there, but it seemed so complicated for me. And one of the things I really appreciate about the film is that when the comics are going to the clinics, they're asking the kinds of questions that feel relatable to me. They're not asking from like the perspective of a politician or from the perspective of like a news anchor. They were just asking like, what, like this, what, like, why does that make any sense? And I found that very relatable. And so that's, you know, part of why I was excited to help with this too, is I feel like we need more of that kind of communication where you can sort of naturally respond to the audacity and outrageousness of some of these laws that happen while we're, you know, just consumed with the busyness of everyday life. So that's what I'm so excited about No One Asked You, and hoping that other folks have a similar reaction and want to re-engage.
With this film and the whole process, especially for you, Ruth, over 7 years, about in the last section, it's that speed up to current day. And it's easy to feel conflicting feelings, angry, sad by the end of this film, when it reminds us what's happened so quickly in the last handful of years. So how do you hope audiences will respond or feel after watching No One Asked You?
Well, it was really important that once Roe was overturned with Dobbs in Mississippi, that we not only add more comedy, but we gave people the idea that they could all be engaged in the solution. And so it was really great that Liz and her team came up with this day, Operation Save Abortion, where they had 10,000 people streaming for 8 hours in one day, giving people instruction and activities and little bits of information, showing them that each person can do something. Because I think that what we had was a country full of people who were surprised, and we had so much activism fatigue after all that we had been through, you know, in the 6 years before that. Sort of, how do you bring together people to then engage and be able to go out and do something about it? And so what we want people to walk away from the film is that they can be a part of the solution, and they need to be. And if it's you're just going to sit in your bedroom one night and you're going to write postcards, really nice love notes to somebody that's going to an abortion clinic, that's the kind of thing that we really want people to walk away from. They can work on something for an hour a week, an hour a month. They can contribute funds if they have funds, but there's so many different things that people can do, and that men really need to get involved in this fight. So anyone and everyone can do something.
Ruth Lightman is the director of the documentary No One Asked You, and Milwaukee filmmaker Susan Kearns is one of the co-producers. They both joined me ahead of the film screenings in the Milwaukee Film Festival, and both Lightman and Kearns, as well as comedian Lynn Winstead, will be in attendance for the screening this Saturday, and you can find out more information at WUWM.com. The Republican National Convention is coming to Milwaukee in July. You can help shape our coverage by filling out our election survey. You can find a link at WUWM.com. What you tell us will help inform the stories that you hear on Lake Effect and WUWM. In about 15 minutes, we'll help you plan a trip to the Wisconsin Grilled Cheese Sandwich Championship in Dodgeville. But first, we'll learn how hydroponics is helping fight food insecurity in Milwaukee. Keep listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. A new crop of gardeners is growing in Milwaukee. The Hydroponic STEM program introduces high schoolers to agriculture, nutrition, and careers in science. It started out focused on the Amani neighborhood, where Milwaukeeans often have limited access to grocery stores with fresh produce. After its first year, the program is growing to a second classroom in Muskego Way. Milwaukee native Michelle Lyle spent the last decade working as an engineer before coming home to start the program. She joins WUWM's Lena Tran.
How did this program get started? Tell me about how you got into this.
Yeah, so I moved back to Milwaukee in 2018, moving back to my childhood home where we are now, wanted to make sure that I was giving back to my community. I'm the youngest of my siblings, so once I moved away to college and out of state for work, no one was here. Everybody kind of moved on to their lives. And when I moved back, I wanted to bring more of that life back into the house, like with my siblings, with my nieces and nephews. But then just being here, even though the goal was to fix things and have family gatherings here, I still remembered the neighborhood that I grew up with. And some of my neighbors are still on the block as homeowners, and even a few more that have built relationships with each other while I was away. And I didn't want, you know, a lot of my experiences to just kind of be taken as what they call the brain drain of Milwaukee. But now being here and determining how can I really give back to Milwaukee and more specifically the Amani neighborhood. So I started gardening, and I've always known that this area was a food insecure zone just by living here, right? Like I always need to drive so far to a grocery store, especially one that has organic produce, or even restaurants aren't very close and limited. So when I was thinking about what's one of the best ways that I could give back or one of the biggest needs, it was absolutely food in some capacity.
And you mentioned that you started gardening. Were you just doing that out of your own personal interest before it kind of became the program, and then you saw how you could make all these things come together?
So I grew up with gardening. It was just always a part of life, if you will. My grandparents gardened, and my aunts, even my older sister gardened. It was just something that you did. It didn't seem like an odd thing. And even I have fond memories around it, around, you know, being able to go and pick my own tomatoes or cucumbers as a snack, or helping my aunt pick a zucchini and she can make zucchini bread for us. I think I just was used to it. And when I came of age and was out on my own, I just always made a small plot for myself, whether it was just herbs or, you know, small fruit as tomatoes and cucumbers and things.
That's so cool. So you knew that you wanted to come back home and focus on food insecurity. and you already had this past interest in gardening. How did you connect the dots to be like, hydroponics, this is it?
Yeah, so I realized we've always kind of done hydroponics anyway, with just like herbs and things, putting it in a cup and letting that grow, or an onion that started to sprout and we would put that in water and allow the sprouts to come up as well.
Yeah, I love that. It's like you get two plants.
Exactly.
It's a free plant.
Exactly. So I won in a raffle at the Dominican Center, their annual green and growing event. So I got the unit and I was like, oh, this is cool. I'm going to see how this works. So when fall started to hit, I actually unboxed it and was really thinking to myself like, oh, this has a lot of mechanics to it. And, you know, it's really interesting how I need to schedule my LED, for example, to replicate sunlight, or, you know, the aggregation of the water, you know, is really like how the beetles and worms and things turn over our soil and put oxygen through. So I just found that really interesting. And then I started researching other hydroponic brands that I liked and started buying them, right? So I have the two from Rise that I really liked, and those were the ones that got me interested in being able to share it with other people, because connecting the dots, even with the nutrients that were being added and understanding pH in the water, really helped me connect the dots of chemistry and electrodes in water, and it's so much science that I think we know and recognize but don't really pay attention to because it's not being presented as science. So I started to think about a program with another friend of mine who has the Beyond STEM program, but she works with middle school students. And I was like, hey, how about we do an agricultural engineering curriculum around it? And that's really what made me think this should be a STEM education type of program. That's when I started to build the curriculum and work with other partners. So the National Society of Black Engineers took me on as a partner. We have one professionals chapter in the city, the Milwaukee Area Professionals, but we also mentor our collegiate National Society of Black Engineers students as well. So this really helped us connect with our high school students from a pipeline perspective to get them interested in STEM and moving them through different disciplines of engineering. And then working with the Dominican Center, because they're a great staple in the Imani neighborhood, and really focusing on the holistic neighbor. So whether it's the food insecurity, health, legal matters, they really try to make sure that they're providing needs across the board. And they were partner right away to jump on board as well. And then the Milwaukee Food Council really helped with me being able to buy the materials and everything for the students so that they can have a successful first year of the program.
Wow, what an accomplishment.
Yeah, so that's I guess where it really became its own thing and less of an idea of this is something that should or could be taught.
So is the idea that you're going to schools and kind of holding classes, or are kids going to the Dominican Center? What has it been looking like in practice?
Yeah, so students have been going to the Dominican Center, and coming up they will be going to the beginning as well. I want them to be able to maintain the community focus. I think that if we're teaching them in the community and they're able to apply benefits of the program within their household as well as with their neighbors and just in the community holistically, I think that will have a stronger impact than the schools. For a couple of reasons. I know that there are, you know, just the school year, right? And things change in the summer, whether it's summer school or not. It is limiting for the students in that regard. I also think that them being able to walk past the community center or go in there when it's not just classroom hours makes a stronger connection between what they're doing and why they're doing it. And I think that will give them a stronger hold, and even if it's not making the commitment to the community holistically, but making the commitment to themselves around healthy eating.
So what does it look like for kids to participate in the class?
The days vary based on the topic. So there is some traditional lecture time just to kind of make sure that they understand the basics. But there are a lot of labs included, so they get to do experiments and understanding. There is a lot of habit building, so they grow their own microgreens, and part of it is they grow the microgreens and make their own microgreen salad, so they know what microgreens are and how they taste and how it relates. And then they're also understanding the nurseries that they have when they first plant the seeds and moving them to the units and watching them grow throughout the rest of the summer. I would like to build this out. And we're marching towards that. We're definitely setting stones in place for the students to have a year-round apprenticeship where they can maintain the units and go through multiple harvests throughout the year and being able to see different types of vegetables grow, and that they can take these things with them once they've finished their harvest cycle.
What kinds of reactions are you getting from the kids that are participating in the classes?
It varies. So in the beginning, of course, it's a lot of apprehension.
Like, what is a microgreen?
Right. Like, what? And you want me to eat that? So it's a lot of, you know, educating around what makes something organic versus not. What is healthy for them? Why it's healthy for them? And how plants really support our bodies, not just, you know, that we eat and we're full, but really eating plants that help us have better clarity or relieve stomach aches and headaches and things like that. So making that correlation is always a big eye-opener for students because they never really think about plants in this way. The microgreens are really funny because they are always like, are we going to eat grass? It's like, it's not grass. It's not grass. But then that's always an opener for me to kind of share, you know, it's different ways that we're using plants. And even though we see this thing growing wildly, it can also be intentionally growing in our gardens.
What do you hope that kids take away from participating in these labs and classes with you?
Yeah, so first I want to expose them to what's out there and what healthy eating is, what can be applied using STEM beyond just building bridges and buildings. If you ask what an engineer does, that's usually what someone will tell you, but it's a wide range of what engineers do. So that exposure piece. The second one is the awareness of what they're eating and how it impacts their bodies, as well as, you know, what type of things that they can do in the future from a career standpoint and how it relates to what they're learning now. And then lastly, a behavioral change and empowering them to have the choice of that behavioral change. So one, to change what you're eating, the frequency of what you're eating for a matter of balance, but also actively seeking out the science and mathematics courses in school and looking at universities that offer engineering and other STEM-focused degrees to pursue those type of careers.
So kids that are interested in participating, if they wanted to do that, they would need to go to the Dominican Center or Muskego Way?
Yeah, so we started recruiting of students in April. Currently also kind of looking for instructors as well and program coordinators. We go to the schools as well as Canvas the Neighborhood because we do want those Muskego Way students as well as the Amani students to know that we're here and how we're supporting them. Reaching out to principals, putting it on social media, and they're able to complete an online application to just kind of give us their basic demographics of who they are and where they are. Once we've kind of reached our capacity of the students, we close the form at that point. But it's open to all students that are interested and really hoping to build a strong relationship with our MPS schools as well as charter schools to make sure that the high school students know that we're here.
Michelle Lyle is the director of the Hydroponic STEM program. She spoke with WUWM's Lena Tran. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way. But ahead of that, we need some new questions. So submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Then listen for new episodes starting in May on Thursdays during Lake Effect and Fridays during Morning Edition. Later in the show, we'll learn about a mermaid teaching young people about environmental conservation through underwater performances. But first, quail eggs on a grilled cheese sandwich? That's just a sample of the ingredients you'll see at the Grilled Cheese Sandwich Championship in Dodgeville. We'll tell you about it next on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. There's an artistry to making cheese. There's also an art to sandwich making. And those two things come together at the Wisconsin Grilled Cheese Sandwich Championship. It began as a way to raise awareness about the important role that Wisconsin's dairy farmers play in the state's economy. And now it draws thousands of people from around the country to test their grilled cheese sandwich making skills. It's happening next weekend in Dodgeville, and for this month's Wandering Wisconsin, we're going to help you plan a trip to check it out. Lake Effect's Becky Mortensen is joined by Jenna Vondra, the executive director of the Dodgeville Area Chamber of Commerce, and Amanda Weibel with Travel Wisconsin.
Jenna and Amanda, welcome to Lake Effect. Thank you for being here for Wandering Wisconsin.
Glad to be here.
Thanks for having me.
I'm pretty excited about today's topic. We're going to learn about the Wisconsin Grilled Cheese Championship in Dodgeville. The name kind of gives it away, but Jenna, could you start by just describing what this event is?
Sure. So this event is a one-day event. It's a family fun-filled day. We have a sandwich, grilled cheese sandwich competition that happens. And then if you're not competing, we also have vendors, exhibit tables, food trucks, food booths. We have kids area, Bloody Mary bar, wine, and beer garden as well. So the event is held on April 20th. Doors open at 10:45 and the competition starts at 11 a.m. and goes until 4. It is held at the Lay Memorial Pavilion at Harris Park in Dodgeville.
Right. And this isn't just a few people with their spatulas standing in front of frying pans. This competition draws thousands of people to Dodgeville. Is that right?
That is correct. We draw people in from all over the United States. Last year, we had a big group from Ohio. We've had people from California, Oregon, Iowa, all over the place. So it draws in a lot of people to Dodgeville.
And what does it take to compete? Are all the contestants, you know, culinary experts, or can anybody try their hand at this competition?
No, anybody can join us. So we have competitors that start at the age of 12 and they go to all ages. We have our amateur competition and then we have our professional competition. But our youth just compete. That's the ages of 12 to 17, but all levels can compete. You don't have to be a top chef to be in the competition.
Right. And it's kind of divided up into different competitions throughout the day. Is that how that works?
Yeah. So we have our youth. We have amateurs, then we have professionals, and then we also have a category for first responders.
So what makes an award-winning grilled cheese sandwich? How is this competition judged?
Yeah, so we have lots of different creative options that you can try. Last year, our professional winner used quail eggs. Everybody uses different things. You can use pesto. People have used bacon, ham, just different kinds of things that you can use. So it's as creative as you want to get, I guess.
Okay, so not mom's grilled cheese sandwiches. There's some variety in there, it sounds like.
Yes, for sure.
So what's this experience like for people who come who aren't participating in the competition? If they're just there to hang out, have a good time, what would that experience be like for people?
Yeah. So if you're not competing, we do have a area set up where you can watch the competitors compete. And it's kind of exciting. They only have about 3 minutes to make their sandwiches. So you can sit around and watch them and have to raise their spatulas when they're all done. So that's really exciting to do. It also gives you time to just spend time with family. We have 5 different food trucks that will be there, 2 different food booths. We have 17 vendors that will be at our area that will be selling all different sorts of goods. Fox 47 will be there with their Lego Masters. And so kids can give their hand at building different Lego creations. And then you just, it's just a time to hang out with family and friends and watch a little family-friendly competition.
Okay, so it sounds like there's some other food options, but do people have a chance to try any of these grilled cheese sandwiches that are being cooked up for the competition?
So the sandwiches that are made by the contestants, you must purchase a VIP ticket in order to taste those creations. It depends on how many contestants we have, that how many bags that are available that we sell. This year, we are not pre-selling all of our VIP bags, so there will be some available at the door for purchase, but they are limited to a certain number of bags that we have available.
Okay. So people might need to walk off all those grilled cheese sandwiches after this competition, and there are two great outdoor recreation areas nearby. One is a place I really like called Governor Dodge State Park. So, Amanda, what can you share about that place?
Governor Dodge State Park really is a jewel of the Wisconsin State Park system. It is just outside of Dodgeville, and it's 5,000 acres, so it's one of our largest state parks. It preserves this gorgeous stretch of the Driftless area. You're going to find these steep hills, deep valleys, and sandstone bluffs, which date back 450 million years. The park's full of recreational opportunities of all kinds, so you can go swimming or boating or paddling on the two lakes. It's also a terrific destination for horseback riding, and there are nearly 40 miles of trails for hiking to walk off those grilled cheese sandwiches. I definitely suggest checking out the Lost Canyon Trail. It has really beautiful scenery, and it also takes you past Stevens Falls, so always fun to chase waterfalls when you're on a hike.
Yeah, I love Governor Dodge State Park. It feels kind of like a natural playground for adults. I always have a good time there. And another is Military Ridge State Trail. I understand that's a favorite of yours, Amanda.
Yes, my family and I love to go biking on the Military Ridge State Trail. It stretches 40 miles from Governor Dodge State Park in the west to just outside of Madison in the east. And it is also a rail trail, which means that it's a path built on a former railroad route. So it's flat, it's really easy riding, but there's also beautiful variety in the scenery. It passes through agricultural lands, woods, wetlands, prairies. There's this great little pond just outside of Riley where we always have to stop and get off our bikes and look for turtles because there's always a bunch of turtles there. So it's a great way to do some exploring.
Right. So if people are coming from out of town, which it sounds like you do get a lot of people visiting for the grilled cheese competition, there are a few hotels and motels people can stay at in Dodgeville. But I want to talk about one in particular, the Don Q Inn. Amanda, can you describe what an experience at the Don Q is like?
Yes, it's hard not to do a double take when you pass by the Don Q Inn. I mean, most Wisconsin hotels don't have a large Boeing jet parked out front. But the Don Q Inn isn't like most Wisconsin hotels. The jet that I mentioned was actually flown to its present location decades ago, and it's open for public tours on the weekends, so you're definitely going to want to check that out. But it's equally known for the creative designs of its themed guest suites. So if you've ever wondered what it's like to sleep in a bed shaped like a Viking boat, they've got you covered. Or if you want to feel like you're in a hot air balloon, the up, up, and away room is definitely for you. They have these great rooms that bring fantasy to life, from their ancient Rome room to Robin Hood's Sherwood Forest. So it's definitely going to be a fun and memorable stay.
Yeah, Amanda, I think you know I like weird stuff. So that I'm a fan of Don Q for sure. So my last question for both of you. What is your favorite way to make and eat a grilled cheese sandwich? Jenna, why don't you go first?
I am pretty plain Jane, so I like your traditional. I think if you're going to stretch it out a little bit, maybe do a sourdough bread with like a piece of bacon. But I'm not a huge tomato soup fan, so I just kind of like the plain Jane. I'm boring, I know.
No, that's okay. What about you, Amanda?
Well, I have been so excited to talk about this. You know, I've been thinking about the technique and I've been thinking about the ingredients. And I think we're already all at such a great advantage being in Wisconsin. We have so many options for great local cheese shops to choose from. But I also think a great one-stop shop to get all of your ingredients is the farmer's market. So I definitely recommend when you can go to the farmer's market, get some fresh local bread, pick up your cheeses. Maybe you want to get a fresh tomato if that's in season, or some pesto if you're feeling adventurous. But I would recommend start with a high-quality soft bread, butter the outside of each slice. And then a tip I recently got was to sprinkle garlic powder on top of the buttered bread. So that is now a must for me. And then use at least two different varieties of meltable Wisconsin cheese, like maybe a Yum Cheddar and Havarti. So then grill it to golden brown, slice it diagonally, and enjoy.
I love that. I'm kind of with you, Jenna. I'm your pretty standard plain Jane grilled cheese sandwich. But the one thing I do is mayonnaise instead of butter. So if you've never tried that, that's my recommendation.
I will have to give that a try.
All right, Amanda and Jenna, thank you for being here for Wandering Wisconsin.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you
us.
For having me.
Grilled cheese sandwich.
Amanda Weibel is the communications officer with Travel Wisconsin. And Jenna Vondra is the executive director of the Dodgeville Area Chamber of Commerce. They spoke with Lake Effect's Becky Mortensen for our series, Wandering Wisconsin. You can find more information about the Grilled Cheese Sandwich Championship at WUWM.com.
I'll laugh in your face if you offer me cake. Don't waste my time with your Brussels sprouts. If you make me a steak, I'll just throw it out. I want a grilled cheese, not a BLT.
Have you ever wanted to meet a mermaid? Well, now's your chance. Echo is a UW-Milwaukee grad student who performs as Mermaid Echo. Mermaiding is wearing or swimming in a mermaid tail, and Echo has been doing that for over a decade, all in the name of educating young people. Lake Effect's Excret Nunez spoke with Echo about their passion for environmental conservation.
I've been following your work as Mermaid Echo for a while now, and something that stood out to me is your passion for freshwater conservation. Where does your passion stem from?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that I was inspired to care about freshwater ecosystems ever since I was a kid. I grew up on the St. Croix River, and it was a beautiful ecosystem, but of course it was kind of undermanaged, and so we'd often take our boat. We are very privileged to have access to boats. We'd take our boat out on the river and find trash in the water, and I remember trying to stay underwater for as long as I could to look at all the fish, and I'd be sad when I find like a piece of trash under there. And I'd bring it up and make little piles of trash on the boat deck. And for some reason, that's a core memory. And so since I was a kid, I, whether consciously or subconsciously, have been, I guess, trying to find a pathway in life that would put me around water as much as possible. And now we're here. I think I'm closer now than I have been ever before, which is really, really exciting.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I guess, did this passion for freshwater conservation have anything to do with your decision to pursue mermaiding? Is that even
no,
the right term?
No, mermaiding came first, actually.
Oh.
Yeah. So I think I've always cared about the water, but I was, you know, as a kid, like, ignorant to how much of an issue we are facing in the climate crisis in regards to freshwater access and preservation. Obviously, I didn't have any of that language, you know, as a five-year-old. But the reason why I started mermaiding was I had surgery on my ankle, and then I had to recover from that, and I did that through swimming. And one way you can, like, strengthen your, you know, injured limb is by attaching it to another one. So if you break a finger, you tape two together. You know, same thing happens for feet. So I would swim with a monofin where both of your feet are in one fin, and that would help strengthen the weak one. And eventually I found a tail skin that went over the monofin and up to your waist like a skirt, and it looked like a mermaid tail. And on that same website, I found that tail. My first tail, I found a website. It's basically Facebook for mermaids. It was called themernetwork.com, now kind of defunct. But on there, I saw that people were using mermaiding as an avenue to educate kids about conservation. And instantly I was like, well, I'm starting a business. I'm 16, but I'm doing it. You know, I had no idea what I was doing or what I was getting myself into. But I just the idea just like clicked with something very integral, I think, to who I am and what I love. But when I was in high school, I was very, very bad at math and science. And my teachers were always pulling me in after class, you know, saying we need to sit down one on one and work on this stuff. And I was just mortified. And then I couldn't deny the fact that I wanted to be telling more people about freshwater ecosystems. And so I said, as a joke, I'm not smart enough to be a scientist, so I will become a mermaid, because that is one avenue in which I can teach kids about the water, in which I don't have to have, you know, this crazy scientific background. I only have to know basic, you know, education principles and outreach principles that I can teach kids. that worked well for a while until I started doing it much more professionally, and I learned that there is so much I didn't know. But I just kept having this bug and this itch to get into science and really learn the nitty-gritty behind, you know, why is there only 4% of research done on freshwater ecosystems when everything else is done on marine ecosystems, when freshwater is our vital resource for survival? And now I get to say that, you know, I told myself I couldn't be a scientist, but I was wrong. Now I'm a scientist and a mermaid. So that's the full story of where I came from and why.
That's pretty amazing. Like, you proved yourself, I guess, to other people, but to yourself, too, that yeah. that you're able to do this. Why is it important to you to educate young people about caring for our freshwater systems specifically?
Oh my God, thank you for this question. Yes, amazing. Yes. Okay, so this, I'm gonna get on my soapbox a little bit. We're gonna talk about why we need to be putting conservation education into the hands of young kids also. Yes, we need to talk to policymakers. Yes, we need to talk to corporations. Yes, you can do your part to like not use a plastic straw and use reusable water bottles. Great, wonderful, love it. That means nothing if the next generation doesn't also know about this stuff. If the next generation is not brought on board to this party we're having, it's going to go all in the trash, all of our hard work. So let's do all of that, but let's also bring kids into the conversation, because we know that the climate crisis most negatively affects marginalized communities, you know, BIPOC, trans kids, lower income communities. And we also know that conservation education, historically, at least based on the research I know, is delivered only to more affluent neighborhoods, right? We're talking the nature preschools, and private schools have often conservation curriculum. Public schools do not, you know, and often it is the first to be removed if we have extra time for it at all. And so that's a problem. And in order to continue to have a world that we can live in, we need to know how to prevent climate degradation from getting exorbitantly worse. And so I think that by investing in edutainment, or at least conservation education, at the K-12 level, we are really doing preventative measures to make sure that the hard work we're doing now in policy will be preserved. We need to ensure that our futures are going to be okay by providing access to this kind of stuff to the kids who it will be affecting the most and who don't have access to it right now. So that's my soapbox. That's why I'm doing all this.
Yeah. Wow. And what's the biggest takeaway you hope young people leave with after your performances or class lesson?
I hope kids take away the knowledge that they can make a difference. And so I have this little pledge that I do at every single event I've ever done. I wrote it when I was 17, launching my business, and it hasn't changed. And kids that come to shows take that pledge, and it basically says that they can make a difference just by being themselves and committing to learn about this stuff and to tell other people. That's really what it's all about. You have the power to make change just by talking to people. You don't even have to make a huge habitual change in the way you live your life, but just tell people, like, just talk about it. You know, somebody out there has the resources to make big substantial change across corporations and policymakers. Great. Just talk to them. You know, it's not all on your shoulders, and working together can really make a big difference. And I think kids often in the topic of conservation are scared. You know, it is a scary topic. But if we say to kids, like, you have the power to be the change maker that will save our Great Lakes, there's a really empowering message there that isn't scary, is accessible, and also gives them agency. So inspiring them is the way to go, I think.
My last question to you, I've read that you'll be graduating this December.
Yeah.
Do you think you'll continue your work as Mermaid Echo after you graduate?
For sure. Yeah, absolutely. I've been speaking with a couple of clients about procuring different sort of bigger moves in my field. This is so vague. I hate it when people do this, but I have to do it. About different bigger moves and different plans. And that they're all very, very exciting. And they're definitely moving in the direction of where I want to go, which is so exciting for me. So I cannot wait to see those come to fruition so I can share with you and with everybody what they are. But they're all surrounding the idea of just bringing more conservation education into the hands of the people who need it the most, whether that's through public performance art or private appearances, whether at birthday parties or elsewhere. I'm very excited about all of those opportunities. So yeah, I don't foresee me not being a mermaid anymore anytime soon. I'll probably be in a wheelchair and then still like jump in the lake with my little tail and try to swim around. So when I'm 85 or something.
Big moves on the horizon.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
good.
I'm excited.
Well, Echo, thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
Yeah.
It was great to learn more about you and your work.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here. It was a joy.
Echo was a freshwater sciences graduate student at UWM and teaches about freshwater conservation through their underwater performances as Mermaid Echo. They join Lake Effect's Excrete Nunez. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, and Excrete Nunez join me producing Lake Effect each week with help from Robert Larry. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Mayan Silver, Susan Benz, Eric Vaughn Fellow, Nadia Kelly, and Lena Tran from the WUWM News team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon when we'll explore what's happening at the Foxconn site in Mount Pleasant and how it compares to the plans that were promised when the project was first announced. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.